Daniel just reminded me quite rightly that we do have a bad version of ancient skepticism in the modern era in Constantinides. Space has an end, it doesn't have an end. There's a, no end to the causes, there's an end to causes, there's a first cause. And Hegel was very, very infatuated with those antinomies and did find, so that the antinomies are a model, right, of finding both views equally strong and equally false. And we know that Kant solves them only by phenomena noumena, which is the very thing that Hegel is going to doubt. But certainly, Kant's antinomies are part of the origins of Hegel's idea of dialectic. Paragraph 81 brings up the problem of criterion, and because we know that Hegel did write this early essay on ancient versus modern skepticism, and then we know he knew about ancient skepticism, and therefore when he raises the problem of criterion, we can be near as damn certain that he's thinking of the problem of criterion as raised by Sextus in his Outlines of Pyrrhonism. And just to jog your memory, you all keep Outline of Pyrrhonism next to your bed like I do. That's the right kind of nighttime reading. Sextus says, in order to decide the dispute which has arisen about the criterion of truth, so, right, the problem is, if you're going to be examining natural consciousness, you have to have a criterion to know whether A is true or false. Right? So there's a problem of criterion. What's the criterion by which we judge each form of consciousness? And the problem of criterion is very deep, says Sextus. He says we must possess, in order to judge of any claim, whether it's true or not, an accepted criterion by which we shall be able to judge the dispute. And in order to possess an accepted criterion, the dispute about the criterion must first be decided. So, in order to judge a claim, whether it's true or false, we need a criterion. But now we need a criterion to decide which is the right criterion for truth. And when the argument thus reduces itself to a form of circular reasoning, the discovery of the criterion becomes impracticable, since we do not allow those who make knowledge claims to adopt a criterion by assumption. That is, we don't allow dogmatism. You can't just say, well, it's certainty because I say so. Right? We don't think that's a kosher move. While they offer to judge the criterion by a criterion, we force them to a regress ad infinitum. So, give me a criterion for your criterion. Well, I'll judge certainty by faith, and faith by God, and God, infinite regress. And furthermore, since the demonstration requires a demonstrated criterion, while the criterion requires an improved demonstration, they are forced into circular reason. That is, to summarize, there looks to be an unsolvable problem about the criterion for truth. For will it not be the case that every criterion is either asserted dogmatically, or, since we don't see how dogmatism is going to work, we force you into a regress, a criterion for the validity of your criterion, a criterion for the validity of that criterion, so that can go on forever, or you end up arguing in a circle, right? The criterion for A is B, and for B is A, and you just go round and round. So it looks like every possible account of criterion is impossible. It's either dogmatic, or infinite regress, or certain. It looks like this is a big problem. So when he raises the question of criterion, he's now raising the very problem which he began the entire book, Knowing Before You Know. Right? How do we know knowledge? And now giving it its pristine logical form. The problem of criterion is the logical repetition of the problem of knowing before you can know. That is having the criterion of knowledge. Hegel says, we can solve this problem. And we can solve this problem by all good solutions, by dodging it. That is, it's not that he's going to show you he has a criterion that's not dogmatic or circular and infinite regress. He can't do any of that, right? So what he really does have to dodge it in some way. And he's going to say, I'm going to solve the problem by not having a criterion. Well, hold it. How can he have a story about knowledge and truth requires a criterion, and not have a criterion? This is the story of his dialectical method. So he reminds us in paragraph 82 that consciousness simultaneously distinguishes itself from something and at the same time relates itself to it, or as it is said, this something exists for consciousness, and the determinate aspect of this relating, or of the being of something for a consciousness, is knowing. This hardly sounds like a solution to anything. So what is Hegel doing here, or beginning to do here? Well, one of the things he's going to be doing here, or is beginning to do here, is suggest that all consciousness is minimally a form of self-consciousness. By which I mean that he's beginning to suggest that every form of knowing is an activity. So already, I want you to be, you know, you should have large, suspicious ears. You already know that he's saying something that's incompatible with where we're going to begin in sense certainty. Because his first assumption is knowing is an activity. Right? So he's picking up the rationalist Kantian thought that knowing is an activity. And it's an activity of a certain kind. It's an activity in which I distinguish myself from the object, have an awareness of myself, and relate myself back to that object in some respect. So every act of knowing assumes a distinguishing of the subject from the object and a form of their interconnection. So every act of knowing, or anything we will count as an act of knowing, he's going to suggest, is a form in which the object, every act of knowing presupposes that the object is that consciousness operates with a concept of its object. That when I know I have an idea about what knowing is, and I have an idea about what the objects of knowing are, and I have an idea about how those two things get hooked up together. Consciousness, we might say, has the power to define or constitute itself in a particular way, and in doing so, it defines what truth is for it and what the standard of truth will be. This way of talking should ring lots of bells of familiarity, because the very description of consciousness operates on the assumption of Kant's Copernican chair. So I'm going to suggest to you that the structure of Hegel's method is not presuppositionless, is not about some crazy idea, but rather a generalization of the result of Kant's Copernican turn, or we might say it takes as its starting point the agreed truths of Kantianism for all post-Kantian readers. That is, Hegel is assuming a readership in which everyone agrees that something spectacular happens in the Critique of Pure Reason, and yet, as I said in the first lecture, you can't stay there, right? This knowing appearances, not things themselves, is a form of skepticism. Nonetheless, what Kant convinced his generation of, it was possible to talk to Jacobi, was the following. That's the best way to think about knowledge is to think about judgment. And that all knowledge is a relationship, therefore, between a judgment and an object judged. And that, therefore, remember, this is Kant's solution to the problem of subject-object dualism, is that this relationship is an internal relationship. And it's an internal relationship because what Kant calls the transcendental unity of our perception, the unity of consciousness, is at the same time the idea of a concept of an object in general. That is, what Kant thought is that what he called his categories, the categories by which the knower synthesized, gathered up the information of the senses, and made judgment, those categories were the outline of what it was for something to be an object. So that Kant's theory provided an account of what judgment was, bringing an intuition under a concept, and gave an account of what the world was like, namely made up of substances in relations of cause and effect in space and time. Now, my suggestion is that this idea, so Kant's fundamental solution here, how he got around rationalism and empiricism, was to show that subject-object are not externally related, but internally related. Right? That they're internally related because every judgment presupposes a series of categorical terms of what an object must be. So if I see an event, to use kind of a typical Kantian example, right, it must have a cause. Right? Even if it's turning water to wine, right? I don't think, ooh, mystery. I think, no, ooh, hidden cause. Let's search. And that's necessitated by my concept of an object. Because what it is for something to be an event is for something to have a cause for Kant. Okay. So the Copernican term, this is Kant's advance beyond rationalism and empiricism, was to say that subject-object relationship, subject and object were not ontologically different kinds. Res cogitans versus res extensorum here. Although we thought there was cogitans in extenso, but it was kind of irrelevant. Because what he thought was really the case is the relationship between self and world was an internal relationship. Now, Hegel thinks he can help himself to this method because first of all, he thinks he can help himself to this method because that's who we are. The problems with our current categorical set are really the dualisms of Kantian philosophy. So if you go back to the first week and I gave you a list of problems, they are just the problems of dualism that Kant failed to solve. The first that Kantian philosophy hands over, gives to us these dualisms, so he thinks we're already inhabiting that Kantian world. But he also thinks something else. He thinks that it's easy for us to help ourselves to this because our object in our examination is not atoms or frogs, because his method would not work. His method would not work, or not work easily, if the question was, what is it for something to really, really, really be a frog? And the reason why he would have problems convincing us to adopt this for that is because it would be very tempting for us to be realist about frogs. I don't know what the different theories of frogness are, but whatever they are, it's up to the frog. Right? So about ordinary objects in the world, we are all intuitive realists. Right? And it'll be very hard to say, I'm going to help myself to Kantianism and think hard about frogs. But we're not thinking about frogs. He says we're thinking about knowledge. That our object is not about a thing in the world. It's about knowledge. And now, he says, knowledge is the relationship between a subject and object. That is, knowledge, if that's our object, is going to be something like this. That is, it's got to be, knowledge has got to be, if it's going to be something we examine. And now we're able to think with cognition, with a clear conscience, because whatever your account of knowledge is, you're bound to say knowledge is going to be a relationship between a subject and an object. And we want an account of the relationship between a subject and an object that does not beg the question about what a subject is or what an object is. So what we want for a non-question-begging account of any account of what knowledge may be is to claim that whatever knowledge is, it will be a categorical set of a certain kind. Namely, it will be one that matches up a form of knowing right, with a concept of an object in general. So what he's doing is taking the idea of Kantianism, dropping all the details about the transcendental unity about perception, categories, and just thinking about it as a general mapping of a kind of internal relationship, so that every account of knowledge will have a form of knowing, let's say sense certainty, and every form of knowing, so sense certainty, when I say form of knowing, I mean a certain account of what you think knowing is like. So sense certainty says knowing is like having a certain sensory episode. Immediately. There. Got it. So that's its description of what the act or state of knowing is. And that account precipitates or goes along with an account of what is to be known, a concept of an object that is the internal correlate of that form of knowing. What is it for sense certainty, anyone? Concept of an object.
This.
It's the singular this, determinate this. Immediacy is the way it happens. What is known is a determinate this. Passive. This is. So lo and behold, Hegel's so-called presupposition with starting point turns out to be a little bit mediated. Namely, he's helping himself to the complete Kantian philosophy. That's his starting point. He's starting, in other words, in the middle, which is to say, in his own historical location. So he does not have a presuppositionless starting point. He has a starting point that any of his readers can find methodologically acceptable, above all because it's not bringing with it any of the baggage that everyone worries about with Kant, phenomena, noumena, and all that. Nor is it bringing with it any of the technical assumptions, no transcendental about perception, no nothing. He's just giving you the Copernican turn itself. Just the very idea that we can no longer imagine, right, that our effort as knowers is to approximate ourselves to we know not what, but rather that the activity of knowing involves legislating for nature in some way, and then testing that out. So now, if that looks to you intelligible, we are now in a position to dodge the criterion problem. And we're in a position to dodge the criterion problem because sense certainty itself has a criterion of knowledge, namely knowing this. So now I don't have to ask what the criterion of knowledge is. Every form of knowledge will propose its own criterion. Truth is knowledge of the immediate knowledge of this. And now all I have to do is look on and see if sense certainty really is, in its own terms, knowledge of this. So in this respect, we can stand back and observe sense certainty performing its own claim. That is, this is I always say knowledge perception is written in Missouri. Right? It's a show me state. Right? So what Hegel says to each form of knowledge is, show me. You say you have immediate knowledge of this, show me. Right? So phenomenology now, Hegel's notion of phenomenology, means I am an observer. I can stand back and let sense certainty perform so that every form of consciousness undergoes a performance. And the performance it's going to do is trying to demonstrate that indeed its knowing really is adequate to its criterion of knowledge. And if sense certainty cannot know this, if it cannot know this, if the very idea of sense certainty, namely its passivity, makes knowing this impossible, it dies. It goes under. Fini. No, not fini completely. Now we get determinate negation. So the determinate negation will be, okay, I now need something else here, and it turns out, I won't go through the story this week, but it's going to turn out in order to know this, I'm going to need universals. So my new concept of an object is going to be a thing with properties. And the kind of knowing that knows things with properties is going to be called perception. What happens here, now what allows this reversal to happen, Hegel says, is I realize, or we realize that what was taken to be the this is an in itself. Right now, I'll get Hegel's jargon. So the this is the in itself. And it undergoes this activity of trying to know the in itself, and it discovers that the in itself was not an in itself. It was only an in itself for us. That is, it learns a Kantian lesson. First of all, every form of consciousness is turned into a form of idealism. Realism gets proved over and over. I'll come back to that in a second. And as soon as I get rid of the this and realize that this was merely my projection of a concept of an object, then we're ready now for a new concept of an object to emerge. And, of course, the new concept of an object will have to follow the criteria I laid out before for determining negation. Namely, it must make good the inadequacies of the previous standpoint. And it turns out that all the problems of sense certainty are problems about no knowledge of intuitions without concepts, no knowledge of particulars without universals. So we're going to have to get universals in there. Hence, we get our new concept of an object. And that will give us a new notion of knowing. So it turns out that natural consciousness, so each of these is what Hegel calls a form of consciousness, or is a version of natural consciousness. Remember again, natural consciousness is simply the spontaneous espousal of any position without acknowledgement of its historical or logical condition. Right? What makes it natural is that, to use it in other ways, we always return to immediacy. We always take where we are to be immediate, which we do. It's not a wild, right? Natural consciousness has that structure to it. We are blissfully not very self-reflective. If we were, life would be like reading the phenomenology all the time, and that would be intolerable. Right? And Hegel understands that. Well, so the notion of natural consciousness also has about it, right? There's some necessity to the notion of immediacy. Okay, before I say anything about experience, let me deep breath there. Stop, because I've now done all that complicated in itself for itself stuff under a different accounting. Are there any now questions about this structure? This is what the structure we need to get going, and this is the structure that solves the problem of criteria.
Yeah. I can see how that can get away from an infinite regress, but it seems like there could be like an infinite progress.
It could.
Okay, so that's allowed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I said, going forward, the phenomenology is a gamble. We don't know it's going to end. Now we can understand what he meant by the goal is already set. The goal is already set. When a concept of knowing and a concept of an object no longer enter into contradiction with one another. That's it. So all this stuff, Heidegger says, the absolute wills of self, just crap. Right? Take on the perfectly modest, deflationary, formal criterion. You end when everybody's happy internally. That's it. And it may never happen. Don't worry till you get there. So, this tells us something about the structure of the book, and what you must be alert to in reading the book. That is, minimally, the book operates from two perspectives. Namely, so the question is, who is the we? Hegel always says, who is the we? And the best account of this in the literature is still, I think, Kenley Dove's really wonderful essay from 1969 on Hegel's phenomenological method. Gives a wonderful account of all the different accounts of who people think the we is. I now said the we begins as, and this is observing consciousness, we post-Kantian philosophers. That's who the we initially is. It's we unhappy Kantians. We German idealists who can find no satisfaction. After 15 or 20 weeks of this, you may think, come on, just get a life. Don't worry about it. But we who can find no satisfaction. So the structure of every chapter, so this is going to be important to how the story goes. And this is now moving forward to paragraph 86 further on. There are two perspectives. The perspective of natural consciousness, and the perspective of we, or observing consciousness, and which is to say what allows the phenomenology to happen. It's a phenomenology is because we stand back and watch the various forms of natural consciousness come up, do their little performance, defeat themselves, disappear, and another form of natural consciousness arises. But that's not exactly all that happens, because we are observing this, and so we are keeping track of this story. So in every chapter, there are moments, so every chapter has at least two voices, and when you read each chapter, you must rigorously distinguish between the two voices. The voice of the we, or philosophical consciousness, or observing consciousness, and then the bit where there actually is a phenomenological demonstration, that is, the internal performance of a certain position carried out from the first person point of view. So there has to be, right, observing consciousness, natural consciousness, and for example, just to look at sense certainty for 1 second. So, sense certainty begins paragraphs 90 through 94. That's all the voice of the philosopher. Right? Hegel's sending it up, telling about this position, saying what he thinks about it. Then, paragraph 95, change of voice. It is this, then, that sense certainty itself must be asked. What is this? All right, and now sense certainty is going to be pressed, right? And there are complications with sense certainty, because sense certainty doesn't want to talk. We will have to make it talk and have a lot of arguments about whether this is a form of epistemological terrorism or whatever, whether this is coercive. Feuerbach thought it was an illegitimate act of coercion of sense certainty. I'll say a lot about Feuerbach's complaints next week. So this question of voices is terribly important. And in sense certainty, it has lots of problems. So sense certainty looks to be very easy, but you can get very worked up about it. And maybe now that I've told you you can, you all will come in and be very worked up about it. But all I want to say here is, notice the two voices. The shift from the philosophical voice to the phenomenological voice of natural consciousness. The only account I know of that gives a breakdown of the entire book in terms of these two voices is as an appendix to Kojève's Introduction to the Reading of Hegel. The appendix breaks down every bit of the book and asks, who's talking? Is it the philosopher talking, or is it a phenomenological demonstration? So, this is at least a two-voice book. At some point, observing consciousness had better have a moment of recognition. That is, at some point, the philosopher better say something like, "Whoo, that's me!" Right? So it has, you know, that moment, Walker Percy's The Movie Goer, where he suddenly sees his hometown in a movie. He says, "Wait a minute, you mean it exists?" Right? My hometown's a character in the movie. So at a certain moment, you who have thought yourself beyond this process have to, as it were, have a moment where, as in any narrative, you identify with the hero or heroine, and you too must go under. So that much of the structure of the book is also about the relationship between these two. It's not just a hands-off one, because after all, it is natural consciousness that must get to the point of being able to write the book. But observing consciousness, in a certain sense, has always already written the book. So in a certain way, the ending must involve necessarily a synthesis of the points of view of observing consciousness and natural consciousness, or what is the same. Right? To say it another way, there's no such thing as an omniscient narrator. There's no frame narrative. Or to say it in another way, that's what my first book was about, the conscious theory of the novel. The biographical form, this is the biography, the story, the life of natural consciousness, for us moderns, always precipitates an autobiographical form. All biography, as we know, is already always autobiography. We can't. Why? Because we can't get rid of the first-person perspective. Right? There's a necessity to the first-person for us. So two points of view. But something else is going on here between these two perspectives. Hegel talks about experience. He says on page 86, after laying out this structure of now self-comparison, that's why it's a phenomenology. He says, now notice, I have said all of this, I never once mentioned thesis, antithesis, synthesis, or mention the phrase dialectical method of thesis. If you say that in a paper or in the class, you fail. Okay? We're done with that. There is no such thing. There is a logic of experience. So whatever you thought Hegel was about, if that's what you come here for, you're in the wrong class, go take physics. You may do that physically. We don't do that here. Lenin aside. Inasmuch as the new true object issues from it, this dialectical movement, and the dialectical movement now is discovering that, again, what was an in itself is an in itself for us, hence the changing of our understanding of ourselves, because what we thought was in the world was not in the world, but in our conception of the world. Hence we have to re-describe ourselves as knowers, and as soon as we re-describe ourselves as knowers, we have precipitated a new concept of an object in general. That's the movement. Inasmuch as the new true object issues from it, that is, the comparison and the defeat, this dialectical movement, which consciousness exercises on itself, said certainty does this to itself. I don't do it to it. It does it to itself. discovers it is cannot be satisfied, there is no internal correlation, it is forced to wonder, and which affects both its knowledge and its object. It cannot be sense certainty, and its object cannot be this, is precisely what is called experience. Ephemeral. Experience is first the loss of the world. The primary experience is learning from suffering. That's what he means by experience. The suffering here is, why lose the world? Because for all the world, if I believe in sense certainty, I think I am a sense certain individual, and I'm connected to the world by my immediate relation to this is. And if that breaks down, I have nothing. I have nothing. I've lost it all. That is, I've lost the categorical set that constituted my relationship to the world. Right? That's what this is supposed to be. It's not just a little bit of knowledge. Right? The sense certain person thinks, no, this is how human beings, qua human beings, are in the first instance, in their deepest stratum, connected to the world. If they're not connected to the world like this, they're not connected to the world, and everything is nothing. Each form of consciousness has that deep hyperbolic structure. Hence, the breakdown is, in the first instance, this loss of the world. But it is also the emergence, Hegel says, of the new object. Now the problem here is that the way things go for natural consciousness is in fact not very tidy. And what I mean by that is the following. Think about Kuhnian paradigm shifts. Kuhn says, look, paradigms go along happily, and then anomalies start to accumulate. And anomalies accumulate and accumulate, and he says, whoa, there's a crisis. That crisis can last forever. Nothing needs to end the crisis. In fact, for some people, the crisis never ends. But for some others, say those who suddenly discover Newton, they wake up one morning and the world's just fine. They're Newtonians. Now, for them, for the Newtonians, what their sense of themselves is, the world's a Newtonian whole, we're confident of this, and they carry on. What they don't see is the relationship between their Newtonianism and the pre-Newtonian Ptolemaic, whatever is going to be your pre-Newtonian position. That is, they don't see their position as arising out of a reversal of the growing anomalies in the previous position. They just think, woof, we're Newtonians, and we can see what's wrong with those pre-Newtonians. Only us historical observers understand that position B emerges out of the reversal of position A. So Hegel says It's paragraph 87. This is terribly important. That what I'm trying to suggest here is natural consciousness undergoes a series of conversion experiences. An experience is a conversion. You wake up one morning and you're a Newtonian. Some of you woke up one morning and you just go, I'm a Heideggerian, I'm 11. You know, you wake up, you don't
rustle and, you know, you get that half.
No! It's not the way change happens. Change happens by conversion. By turning around. Why? Because what typically, as Hegel says, what allows us to move on, what allows us to move on is being in possession of a new truth. So, before the new truth arose, we couldn't do anything. We were in crisis. Once we had the new truth, the crisis was gone. So, we somehow are never in the position of seeing the connection between crisis and resolution. We might say that seeing it as a pattern of crisis and resolution is to see it as an education. And that is what Hegel says, observing consciousness adds to the story. That is, we have these blocks of natural consciousness going through these terrible experiences, and what we add is an understanding of them as a movement from A to B to C and so on. Right? We see them as a progress and an education, that is, we see them as a learning sequence or a developmental sequence. Which is to say that, for the most part, learning and development happen behind our backs. Think about your own, you know, wrestling with a hard philosophical text. Struggle, and you finally give up. And you kind of come back 6 months later, and you're reading this, and you think, wait a minute, I understand this. How come? How do I suddenly, why did I find this so difficult? Very rarely, so that learning happens in quantum leaps, for the most part, and only therefore, so only retrospectively do we see learning, right? Do we understand that learning has happened, that is part of the developmental sequence, and the like. The rare examples of this are practicing skills, where you can kind of feel often day to day you're getting a hold of it. So experience for Hegel is learning through suffering, that the forward movement is always a movement of conversion, that it is an abductive inference only for the observer. And for the observer, it is a developmental sequence. Once you have that, then it's fair to say that what the phenomenology is an account of the experience of consciousness, which was the original subtitle of the book, right? The Science of the Experience of Consciousness. But now we know that the experience of consciousness means the whole history of all those experiences by which modern self-consciousness has been constituted in a certain way. and what it means to grasp that. That's the introduction. That's going to be the way that the book works. That's its phenomenological method, its theory of experience. I've given you an account of the we. I've claimed that it's not a presupposition with a starting point with a book. So that if you don't feel yourself in any way tempted by Kantianism, you will find this book unreadable. And you will. I know lots of people find this book unreadable. And it's perfectly clear why. So it is heavily conditioned by its own history. So it starts in the middle. Which means, again, it must, at some point, catch up with its own starting point. So this structure, that's called the fundamental structure of self-consciousness, must actually emerge at some point in the story and be an object. And as I would suggest, it actually emerges very early on, as you might expect. It's the transition between chapter 3 and 4, consciousness to self-consciousness. Okay, questions?
At which point the we begins to see itself implicated in the losses it's observed along the way?
Not initially, not quite. Yes and no. One of the things that's going to happen is, as is already clear, I am assuming that the Copernican position is fundamentally a view about knowledge. As I'll explain more next week, in my reading of the text, the first three chapters are a genealogy of self-consciousness, and they're for the sake of discovering that self-consciousness is not a theoretical mode of consciousness at all. And self-consciousness is always already practical. So the first transition is actually going to discover that we're not knowers, we're agents. So we'll start to identify in certain ways with this. But we won't, so there'll be moments of identification, but also moments of disidentification. Okay, we get to self-consciousness. But then suddenly we're talking about the unhappy consciousness, or we're talking about crazy people beating themselves, and other people going on looking for a bit of Christ's cross. Why would they do that? Really nutty forms of behavior all over the place. And we don't think we're like that. And so we're going to have a hard time identifying with all these characters. And yet all these characters are going to be incipient versions of us, and therefore, that's going to be the difficulty of the reading. Which is to say, like someone, I think it was Manolo Dargis, was talking about Helen Mirren portraying Elizabeth. See, Helen Mirren has the greatness to portray truly unattractive people. People who are just intensely dislikable. And she knows we will like her anyway. Well, there's something about that natural consciousness, as Hegel does it, is like an echo and mirror. That it goes through these forms that we are both repulsed by, and yet must somehow identify with. And that's going to be part of the tension of the book. Part of the difficulty in my teaching the book is what? We must feel, and this is really the trick of reading the book, you should feel for each form of consciousness a moment when you're just tempted to say, even for one second,
Yeah. Okay. I can just about, you know, say, yeah, that could be a world. You have to have that much of the capacity for empathic identification.
And you're implicated.
And you're implicated, yeah. And the book makes that, but I'm saying that the book makes that question of self-implication difficult, right? And that difficulty is doubled by the fact that these two are held apart in a way throughout, only at certain moments to go undergo certain implications. Yeah.
I understood your kind of relationship between the two. It seems as though the event of conversion, the happening of conversion, has to be an activity of natural consciousness. It has to be moving from one natural consciousness to another, essentially.
Yeah.
And so my question is, a simple one, which is just, what is it about natural consciousness that makes it capable of being the motor of historical progress in that way? Whereas
unhappiness.
So then observing consciousness, the structural belatedness of observing consciousness is always is necessary to the extent that it's always already happy. We're to believe that observing consciousness is...
No, that's right. You asked, the first question was, what gives natural consciousness the oomph to go forward? My answer is unhappiness. That Hegel takes seriously the thought that as human beings, not as philosophers, but as human beings, we require some sort of satisfactory categorical articulation of our being in the world. That is, we have to have, let me say what that means. I'm saying, and I think this is Kant's great insight. Kant understands, and Hegel is going to follow him here, that to be a human being is to have a picture of yourself and a picture of the world and have an account of the relationship between yourself and the world. To have such an account of self and world is to have a philosophical position. That gives you what it means to be a human being, what it means to have a world, and therefore they have to, if you are to be in any way intelligible to yourself as a human being, in harmony with one another. Because unless they are in harmony with themselves, right, then my world is incoherent and I have no direction, I don't know how to act, I don't know how to not act, I don't know how to do anything. So this categorical set articulates how I am to navigate the world in general. Okay. Now therefore, by what Hegel does is take these structures and condenses them to their categorical essentials. Right? Takes them out of the messy business of the life world, condenses them to their categorical essentials, and then forces, in a certain sense, their inhabitants to enact their meaning. Right? And therefore, natural consciousness is going to have to make sense of itself in relationship to its own account of the world. The failure of that really is the loss of self and loss of world. So the stakes here are immensely high. So when I say unhappiness is the motor, I mean that you might say nihilism is the motor, or you know, anxiety is the motor. All these sorts of things that are our general way that we have to make sense of the world. Right? And of course, the difference between this and everyday life is here, it's all stripped of ideology, of practical necessities, all the things that
protect us from the fragility of our categorical sets. Right? Mostly our categorical sets aren't under the kind of intense pressure that they're under here. And only at certain moments in history or at certain moments in our lives do our categorical sets come under intense pressure. So, you know, you thought that love was going to save you and be the meaning of your life. You fall in love, you get married, you're madly in love with your husband or wife, and you're not satisfied. And that means that love cannot be what you thought it was as a form of being in the world, and you require some other access to the world. So at certain moments in our lives, those things we most value, most think anchor us, most orient us, break apart. They do so historically in revolution. So it's unhappiness that's the motor. The job of observing consciousness is to acknowledge that this process of going under and new forms arising, itself is not arbitrary, and it has a meaning and structure. So natural consciousness, right, didn't have the thought of history. I mean, history is a very new category for us human beings. So this notion that we're constituted historically is a new thought. And that our lives can be, you know, various frameworks. All these are new thoughts. And Hegel is, as it were, one of the first ones to try to make sense of it. Hamlet may be the first person to suffer it. I think that's my reading of Hamlet, right? He suffers the loss of frameworks. Discovering that frameworks are just frameworks is Hamlet's terrifying discovery. And then he has to make sense of life without a framework. That's what he thinks subjectivity means. And that's what Hamlet means as a play. Right? And it turns out you can't do it. So Hegel wants to set this structure up. So Hegel really does think this is the structure of not just knowing, as it turns out, but of what it is to be a human being in the world, of which knowing turns out to be, the book starts here, one of the worst, most thinnest, most uninteresting, most stupid ways of thinking about what a human being is. I'm a knower. I represent the world. Whatever made someone think? Well, there's a long story here. And the answer, by the way, there is an answer. The answer is natural science. Discovering natural science is a good answer to why, for a certain moment, we thought of ourselves as pure knowers. I don't have an answer for Plato and Aristotle, but that's why we modernists. Hegel's convinced that's a bad, bad answer, and he gets rid of it in the first three chapters. Epistemology is first philosophy. Done in 100 pages. 500 pages to go, so we know anything about that. So whatever philosophers have been doing for the last 250 years, mistake. Does that kind of help?
Yeah. Would it then be fair to say that in order for a natural consciousness to perform its role as historical motor, it needs to contain a moment of unconsciousness of historicity of its particular form?
No. That's the job of observing consciousness. Observing consciousness. So that's why I said natural consciousness can be happy in thinking that it's immediate.
Yes, so, that's what I'm saying. So,
but it doesn't need that extra. We can allow it its naturalness. We add to it that it is historically conditioned and see it as historically conditioned. Therefore, minimally, now, for each form of consciousness, there are minimally two descriptions. Its self-description and its description as seen by, right, observing consciousness as historically conditioned. And there'll be a third description namely, as seen by us at the end of the story. Right? So, as just to use, I mean, just to remind you, I was just talking about the great Arthur Danto's idea of what makes sentences historical sentences. And he says historical sentences are sentences that have two descriptions of which cannot be both had at all times. So in 1619, I think it's 1619, no one knew that it was the beginning of the 30 Years' War. Only, or no one knew with the fall of Diem Nam Phu that this was going to be the beginning of America's being dragged into Vietnam and ending up in a disaster. So beginnings can only, so you can describe beginnings in one way as they're seen by their protagonists, and in another way as seen by us at the end. And Hegel is saying there's actually another way, namely as seen by us in the middle, as moving toward the end. So each form of natural consciousness will have three descriptions. Its own self-description, this is who I am and this is how I see myself. Our description of it, so we see perception as the successor state to sense certainty, trying to make good sense certainty. And then we'll see what this looks like at the end. And it will turn out that other forms of consciousness will look a lot like perception, because the problem of the perception is going to be the problem of one in many, and it turns out there are a lot of forms of consciousness that get caught up in the problem of the one in the many, because that's one of these things philosophers think about. Is that? Okay, for those of you who have to capture trains to faraway places, to me, so next week, probably read sense certainty and perception. At the rate we're going, let's hope we get to sense certainty.